Thought maybe I was thinking about in regards to, I don't know in which note Nyanavira talks about seeing a bird and hearing it, and then thinking along the lines of it is the same thing that I'm seeing and hearing, even without experiencing with the thing through two different senses, even just one, like seeing a thing, like tree, a bird. It is, it exists, and I see like the image of this thing. There is this thing existing behind this image which I'm seeing. And that's basically the idea of the external objective world, independent of my experience of it. But you realize it's a contradiction in terms, because if you're seeing it, it's experienced, and if it weren't experienced, you couldn't even talk about it.
But how do you know then that there isn't a real world behind it?
You don't, but you can only assume. You can't know that there is, neither can you know that there isn't.
So there might be. So then it might not be a contradiction.
Yeah, but you could never find it out. I
Sure,
mean, it's.
but that's one thing to not be able to find out. Another thing is to say it's a contradiction. Because contradiction requires you to know that there isn't.
Yeah, what I mean is that it's a contradiction thinking that you can talk about it or think about it.
But we are talking about. See, we are clarifying something.
Yes.
That external world that you cannot know as independent of your experience, that you can only know on the basis of your experience. Yes, there is a contradictory aspect to something. But I'm saying is, you can't say there isn't that world out there because you don't know that, and you can't say that there is because you don't know that. All you know is the result of the experience. Because see, you can start saying, no, there is the public world. Form and objects of the senses are real as such. We all perceive them as a collectively. In my experience, it's just the sensory impingements of these forms. Now you could say, oh, there isn't such a world. It's all in my mind. It's all my experience. Such world cannot exist. But that would also be wrong now to say. So
Yeah.
both go a bit too far. So where is the contradictory aspect in regard to those two statements? What is the contradiction? So it's not the existence or non-existence of the world, because that cannot be known.
So you don't know whether there is something outside of yourself or there isn't. The mistake is this in that statement, this self, this extratemporal.
Yeah, so the mistake, the emphasis is on your conceivings, and the mistake there is, see, I don't know whether there is something outside or not, means I am assuming outside.
Exactly.
I just cannot decide on the content of that outside.
Yeah.
Yet that outside assumption is only known on the basis of this internal experience by me. So the notion of outside is a contradiction in terms. Not the world or not the world, or the world exists or doesn't exist, or both exist or neither exists. And that's exactly what the Buddha would not answer those questions in the suttas. Oh, is the world eternal? I.e., does it exist on its own, independent of our experiences and the individuals? Does it carry on its own? Or is the world then not eternal? And he wouldn't answer that because either way you assume the outside. You assume there is this space outside of your experience as a whole, outside of your sixth sense base, which is then populated by these forms and so on, or not. So, just the conceiving of outside in the basis of your statement, there is the world outside, there isn't the world outside, your conceiving of the outside is the problem. That's the contradiction.
Yeah, so the fact that you think that you can refer to it, would you not say that's
Well, no. You, you can
equivalent?
refer to it, you can think it, but you don't necessarily have to conceive it as an outside, as first and this second to it. You
Yeah.
have to start seeing it as a phenomenon. So when you're referring to the outside, you recognize that that's within. So the point where I'm kind of trying to sort of emphasize here is you should not start believing that I must stop thinking about outside, because every thinking of outside is the conceiving. You can't stop thinking about outside. You are the outside. You are the perversion of perception, so to speak, of the ownership. But what you can do is start recognizing that the phenomenon of outside of this experience, as real as it is, whichever way it feels, whichever way it's perceived, is within the enduring experience as a whole. So instead of trying to manipulate how you refer to outside, you actually want to develop a greater context that includes even the most external sense of experience that you might have in regard to sight, sound, smell, taste, touches. Oh, but it's that's as such is real, and as such a phenomenon, it's my experience as a whole. It's the five aggregates. So you want to broaden your context as opposed to fix the notion of outside.
When Kanavira talks about this analogy of a parasite, like the parasite is real, like as such, in the sense. So it's not denying that there is a parasite.
No,
it's really seeing it as a parasite, and that means
exactly putting it in the context,
putting
it against the right backdrop, so to speak. And right backdrop would be that. Hold on, I have the notion outside. The world exists after me. The world will continue existing. The world existed before. But all those notions are on the basis of conceiving outside of this experience as a whole, yet they are experienced as a whole. I mean, when you say, oh, the world exists, will exist after my death, that is your thought here and now, what you are confined with, what you are experiencing it within these five aggregates. You're still thinking your thoughts on the basis of your sixth sense-based experience, and as such, that is within the enduring five aggregates.
But like ignorance is beginningless, so you already are like doing it. It's not like
it's not like you didn't do it and then you started one morning.
And that's the whole like mula pariah, like conceiving.
It is exactly. So he conceives in a part from he conceives as mine fundamentally. So all these subtle conceivings of outside, first as second, second as first, in all areas of your five sense experience and six and the mind, all that kind of adds up because it's beginningless, and the practical result of that is me and the world. Things that are mine and I am, sense of I am, sense of ownership, sense of self. That's the result of these conceivings. But again, if you read the Mula Pariah Sutta, again, somebody might assume, okay, so I must individually undo these little things. That's impossible. They're just subtle aspects that precede your attitude of mind. So, undo the attitude of mind in regard to the five sense base and the thoughts. Undo the attitude just to the extent of mind. So you're not undoing the thoughts. Just there is a thought of the external world. Undo here and now ownership of the experience as a whole in regard to the thought of the external world. That will maintain the balance of thoughts, sights, sound, smell, taste, touches, and in them is just thoughts, sights, sound, smell, taste, touches. That's it. Not too much, not too little. But it all converges on that sense of mind. So you want to fulfill the Mula Pariah Sutta, you basically practice not mind in regard to everything top to bottom, past, future, present, doesn't matter in what direction. Whatever has arisen, whatever is real as such, as an image, as a feeling, as a perception, not mine to the extent that it, for as long as it endures, it won't be mine. And then the next thing, and then the next thing, and then the next thing.
Yeah.
And you would have diminished all of the conceivings from Mula Pariah Sutta. So what would be a necessary prerequisite for practicing not mine in regard to everything? Sight, sound, smell, taste, touches, thoughts, while they endure. What would be the necessary prerequisite? What do you have to do in order to, for this practice to even become intelligible?
Establish virtue.
Yeah. Like, and I'll keep talking about it for as long as I live. Because it's easy to hear this, okay, so I'll start doing this, yet your whole physical behavior, verbal behavior, remains completely unpurified. Still polluted. Not clear from blemishes. Those are the contradictions of mind, of outside, of lust, aversion, delusion.
You are conceiving a subject.
Exactly. So if you are perpetuating conceivings through your actions and contemplating on the level of mind, I'm mindful and not mine, that doesn't work.
Yeah, basically you have to recognize that your views are
the result.
Perpetuated through your actions.
Exactly.
And
the result of those actions.
Unless, and they're much more coarse and could not even be recognized as views. until you stop acting in those ways.
Absolutely.
And only when you stop acting in those ways can you recognize, oh, actually, just by doing that, without even thinking about it, that's the view that I'm affirming, basically.
Yeah. Through development of virtue and sense restraint, you are then looking at the bigger picture. And now if within that you start making effort to cultivate the attitude of not mine, in, as I said, in whatever's felt, whatever's perceived. So again, it's not about shaping, manipulating or changing what is felt or what is perceived. It's about extending the attitude of not mine in regard to the whatever precious felt, whatever perception is being perceived. So I shall guard the attitude of not mine. That's it. That's my work. That's my threshold. That's I don't go past that point. That's the gateway. And you can. That's exactly why the Buddha then did encourage the noble disciples, sotapannas or higher, who have sort of accomplished themselves in virtue, sense restraint. He said, okay, you should thus go around your day-to-day existence and every whatever you experience, you should regard it. This is not mine, this is not I am. And the reason why it's in that order, this is not mine, this is not I am, it's because your sense of I am, your sense of self, is the result of unquestioned ownership and taking things as mine, the attitude of mine for me. And attitude of mine is the result of attitude for me. So that's like a subtle refinement of the same thing. So, not for me, not mine, not I am. Do I need to repeat it as a mantra? No. I need to repeat it if I forgot about it. But even then, I don't do it for the sake of repeating it. I do it for the sake of reestablishing that context of, oh, not mine.
Not for me.
In regard, not for me, exactly. So, there is this feeling present and that is trying to pressure me to act. Not for me, the pressure to act. Not like, oh, not mine, feeling impermanent, anicca. No, no, no.
Don't try and get rid of
it. It's permanent. It's real. It's going to pressure me forever.
Yeah.
That's not a problem. The problem is, if I take it as mine at any point of that eternity, that's when it becomes a problem. If I don't take it as mine, well, eternity is seen as impermanent. Is seen as unownable. So what's the problem? So you are free from the eternal samsara. There you go.
So, yeah, the world is presenting, it's presented as for you.
It's pointing, all pointing at you, pressuring you, trying to move you, feelings, things that, as I said, you perceive, memories, future plans, doesn't matter. It's all for me, for me, for me, and you just take for granted that, oh, there must be this me, there must be this guy there that all these things point at. But if you realize, well, that's another thought, that's for me.
Conceiving.
The image of myself, the image of a guy there, the owner of this, is another thing that's for me, which means, oh, so I could actually disown him.
People always asking, you know, is there that external world, or is it just the mind, or, you know, where am I in position of this world that lasts for forever, that goes through these cycles, and then when I die, and then I go to this realm and that realm, I travel within that. And so on, and this and that and the other.
The answer to all of those questions is there is suffering and there is freedom from it. If you have such questions after you would have fully resolved liability to suffering, so after you're an arahant, then you can come and we can talk about it.
Hmm.
Everything else is a complete waste of time.
Where that monk disrobes, doesn't he? He disrobes, he says the Buddha's wrong or something like that. And, I will disrobe or... Unless the Buddha tells me whether the world is external, eternal or not. You know. And then the Buddha says, well, did I ever say I was going to tell you those things?
Yeah, come and I'll tell you that. No. Yeah, it's that similar of the arrow. You get shot, a person gets shot by somebody, they bring a surgeon that's really there, right there, and to treat him and save his life by pulling the arrow, dealing with what must be dealt there and then, without wasting any time. But he won't let him do that. He won't follow his instruction to get the arrow out until he finds out who shot him, why he shot him, how tall was the person that shot him, what was his political affiliation, what was his religion, why did he shoot him? What was his childhood? What were the reasons for it?
So
it, and then he dies.
Yeah.
Bleeds out.
So the only reason he's asking those questions is because he has been shot. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's suffering.
Yeah.
I need to figure it out because I'm suffering.
Those questions only arise because those questions are the habits and mental sort of patterns that you developed on account of experiencing suffering, not knowing how to deal with it.
So coming out of suffering is a broader intention to any intention, for example, asking that question. The broadest intention is
coming. You realize this is whatever, like, see, if he were to have time to reflect there while he was dying and bleeding out because he's shot with an arrow, he would realize, wait, but the only reason I'm asking all these questions is because this arrow hurts me. And the only ways of me in the past dealing with any pain is finding satisfaction through senses or thinking and justifications, assumptions and views. That's the sole reason for those things that I was doing them. It was just to cover up and manage suffering. So there is a surgeon right in front of me who says, no, he can actually save my life, and it seems that he can. And the only thing he's asking me is to refrain wasting time on those questions and actually start practicing. I can have those questions, but no. Mm. I'll put them aside. Mm. I'll put my mind thinking those questions. I'll put that aside while I'm doing what needs to be done.
Yeah, you don't have to get rid of them yet.
Yeah. So when people start asking such questions, pretty much the only thing, like, the main thing that would determine whether there can even be a conversation taking place is, do you keep the precepts? Are you celibate? Are you sense restrained? Are you guarding your sense doors? Are you moderate in eating?
Yeah.
And then you would be able to understand the place where those views are, the roots of those questions. Even if you're mistakenly asking them, you could actually then understand why that is wrong from the point of view of practice. But if a person is not making any effort, or minimal effort, or occasional effort, not purified in virtue, not guarding the sense doors, but it's revolving and emphasizing these questions all the time, any answer to that, it's not a practice, it's not a Dhamma, it won't make a difference. That's often like people would kind of have the same attitude towards, oh, what's the Buddhist perspective on doing such and such thing in such and such circumstance? There is no Buddhist. Buddhist perspective is suffering and freedom from it, which means Buddhist perspective is uprooting of the four upadanas, uprooting of sensuality, abandoning of desire, overcoming of attachment. That's the Buddhist perspective. Oh yeah, but no, what do I do like if this happens and I see that? Well, if you're not free from desire, not free from attachment, not free from ownership, whatever you do will be wrong.
So the Buddha wouldn't be helping them in any way by indulging?
No, he might help them in worldly, like somebody's not interested in practicing the Dhamma and tell me what to do. Well, keep the precepts, be a good person, don't harm others, yeah. Do that. But they don't ask the questions like that. People usually ask the questions, no, from the Dhamma point of view. No, there is no Dhamma point of view that tells you how to lead your household life. Dhamma point of view tells you have to abandon it. You have to abandon everything, uproot all of the attachment, be free from craving. That's the Dhamma point of view.
There's no compromise.
Yeah. So if somebody just asks you like an advice how to live a skillful lay life, sure. But don't confuse that for the Dhamma practice or coming from the Dhamma practice, because it doesn't.
So again, with these questions,
the principle of sense restraint comes first, applies even to these thoughts, even to these just mental processes of, oh, who shot me, why he shot me, and all of this. All of this, like, wait, but see, in order to overcome the pain because of which I'm asking these questions, I need to stop emphasizing those questions first.
It's reminds me of the scratching. You're just scratching.
Yes, it's exactly
scratching
the
mind. That's the next question.
It's a scratch, exactly. Yeah. So you have your physical scratches and so on, verbal ones, but yeah, this is a mental one. And then it's, oh, I have to actually stop, endure the pressure. See, because it's going to be like pressure of doubt. But why? Who? Why? What for? What did I do? How did it happen? And he's like, yeah, well, that pressure, those thoughts, has to remain and I have to endure them. And not actually give in to, yeah, let me just answer and resolve this. And that's how I will get closer to uprooting the pain. Because if you have been withdrawn from it sufficiently, then yes, you would be able to apply what the Buddha said, oh yeah, take it as not mine, Not for me, not mine, not I am. Even stuff that is, it could have not been and it won't be. Either way, it can't be for me. Either way, it cannot be mine.
And basically, sense restraint is the necessary basis for even applying, for being able to apply that attitude.
Yeah, yeah.
Because those things that you have to give up just in order to establish basic sense restraint are the things that you would be most pressured into taking as your own. So,
well, there is a reason exactly that those things always come with the pressure.
Mm.
The ownership needs maintenance, craving. And the only reason, again, that you would go act out of pressure is because it's painful. If you stop and think about it, it's like, wait, but what is so bad in not following sensual desire? Like, why don't I do it just for fun?
What? Not follow?
Yeah, not follow. Why don't I just for fun be celibate, not eat in the afternoon, live withdrawn from sensual pressures, just for fun? Why don't I do it?
And consider everything is not for me.
Even leave that for later. Just for fun, let me just not do those act out of those pressuring things. Why nobody does that just for fun? Well, because it's very painful. I was like, well, that's surely... It tells you it's a problem. If something is basically forcing you through pain to maintain it, that's that's not a good deal.
But it's and what would happen just to think about it?
Yeah.
So you just
of course exactly. So even thinking about it theoretically, abstractly, it's painful, and then you dismiss the possibility of that you could do it.
Yeah.
But say you do think about it, and say you do realize, yeah, it is painful, isn't it? And why am I maintaining? If you stop doing it, it's like, what do you have to lose? What would change? So if you're not acting out of pressuring sensualities, enduring the pressure, feels like, oh, this pain will last forever if I don't scratch the itch, but then you still don't scratch the itch.
You're not as liable.
Well, then the pressure starts to diminish. It has to. And you kind of know, even before you start, that it would. Just maybe not as quickly as you would want it to. But it does start to diminish because it requires your input. It requires fueling. It requires maintenance. And you stop feeding it. And again, that's what Buddha said. It is possible, even for an outsider, outside of his teaching, his dispensation, to become fully free from this sensuality. Through not feeding it, overcome the pressure, and see the actual ridiculous, trapping, devious nature of it, and be completely dispassionate towards it. See it as a trap. A ridiculous trap.
So then this passion is... directly proportional to your seeing of the trap, of the nature of the trap, of the thing.
Yeah, but I think practically you could say this passion is directly proportional to your ability to endure the pain
and
of the pressure.
Would reveal the
and that would then reveal the views.